over the last 30 or 40 years, the ownership of Oregon's forests has really shifted. Decisions are made by people who've never set foot on the ground in Oregon.
Oregon has long been a frontier in the conflict between conservation and the timber industry. Last year, large timber companies representing out-of-state investors earned record profits in spite of wildfires and the COVID-19 epidemic. Some Oregonians feel the industry plays an outsized role in public policy. State Senator Jeff Golden is the author of Senate Bill 335-2, a proposal which he believes will remove personal economic interest from public policy. Senators held a hearing Wednesday to discuss the proposed bill.
Shock upon shock, the timber industry doesn't like this bill. And a number of them said it was either unnecessary or destructive, and then it had advocates who did. So the testimony was pretty split. I had appreciated a good opportunity to put it forward and explain what it would do.
And what does this bill do?
This bill, Senate Bill 335, is based on a very simple principle, and it is that the governance of our regulatory agencies should be free from pronounced influence by the industry they regulate. Seems pretty straightforward to me. So the bill does three things. It changes the statutory language around the Board of Forestry. Board of Forestry has 7 members, and right now it says no more than 3 shall have a significant conflict of interest, meaning financial conflict of interest, with forest policy. And those over time have come to be called industry seats, that the industry feels entitled to those 3 seats. So the first thing the bill does is change it to say only 2 can have that kind of conflict of interest, and 1 has to be a small woodlands owner if there's going to be 2. Second thing it does is abolish the Regional Forest Practices Advisory Committee, which by statute, by the membership, are dominantly industry committees. And my problem with them is not that the industry has input into the forest policy and the Board of Forestry. Of course it should. You can't do good forest policy without the industry's input. My problem is that it's the only standing committees. There are 3 of them. And it's, you know, there's no other stakeholder or interest group represented in those internal committees. And they're there all the time, and they are staffed by ODF. And, you know, you don't see a water quality committee or habitat committee or a climate committee or a recreation and tourism committee, none of that. And there are plenty of opportunities for the industry to have input without having embedded committees in the department. And the third thing it would do is transfer hiring and firing of the state forester, the director of the Department of Forestry, from the Board of Forestry to the governor. And the idea there is the governor is the chief executive officer of the state, is responsible for the performance of executive department agencies, and forestry is one of them. And it seems kind of hard and illogical to hold her responsible when she has no say over who the top person is.
And going back to those Board of Forestry appointments, those 2 slots are, they're not reserved. It's a cap for the number of industry people who can be affiliated, right?
Yeah, currently it's a cap. Those 3 of 7, but it seems like everyone thinks of them as industry seats. And there may not even be 3 right now. The board just got a number of new members, but I'm just saying as a matter of structure, if you have 3/7 of your governing board members of the regulated industry, you're not really liable to get the most public interested governance.
And this has not been the only bill targeting the timber industry in this session that's met with resistance.
There's a lot of forestry-related legislation being proposed this year, and a lot of it came out of public awareness from the series of articles about how the timber industry has evolved over the last 30 years. A lot of emphasis about how much of it has moved to hedge funds and Wall Street, and how much less benefit that industry leaves for workers and communities than it used to. And the severance tax was essentially ended in the 1990s. And since then, communities have lost hundreds of millions of dollars. That loss is way more than they lost from the spotted owl. from the curtailment of logging. And, you know, a lot of us think it's really time to look at that again.
When advocates of the timber industry argue against regulations like Senate Bill 335, often they invoke this image of the small lumber company, a small privately owned lumber company, and claim that these bills are going to hurt them disproportionately. And that isn't necessarily true, is it?
You make a really important point. The timber industry is diverse, and it has small local operators that are deeply connected to communities and provide employment and provide, you know, a lot of benefit to communities. You know, over the last 30 or 40 years, the ownership of Oregon's forests has really shifted. And the general trend has been away from Oregon-based firms to kind of esoteric tax creatures like REITs and TIMOs. And, you know, the decisions are made by people who've never set foot on the ground in Oregon. And some people think that's kind of turning Oregon into a colony, a timber colony for an external owner, and in this case, largely Wall Street. So how they operate and the benefits to communities is widely different. And yes, when, you know, we debate these measures in the legislature, you hear about ma and pa timber operators who are, you know, operating at a much lower sales volume. And we can distinguish in policy. If we were to reinstate a severance tax, there are any number of ways to make a distinction. You could start certain tax rates over certain gross sales or certain gross harvest numbers that could protect those ma and pa's that still exist and are kind of disappearing. But I think where there's some consensus among Oregonians is if there is enormous profit from cutting Oregon's forests that flow almost exclusively out of state to investors in these esoteric structures like REITs and TIMOs, they should leave some of that in Oregon communities and help prepare for future wildfire. And that's what the severance tax debate's about.
And those tax profits would go, I'm assuming, towards forestry-related issues and preventing future wildfires?
If we reinstated a severance tax, some of those revenues would go to local governments to try to restore what they've lost, and some would go to help prepare us for the mega fires that are probably coming, because that's a crisis we just don't know how to fund right now.
So Oregon is, at the moment, kind of the nexus of this battle, but it really isn't just an Oregon battle, is it? And when you're arguing in support of bills such as this one, in a way, you're also fighting a national battle against interests that aren't even in the state.
I think you're right that there's a national aspect to these struggles, and it goes beyond forestry. It goes to the different circumstances of small and medium-sized businesses who are trying to exist within their communities and from whom benefits to communities flow and who tend to hire people and sometimes with a living wage to major corporations who have no particular reason to be interested in those communities. And I think you see that across the board in the American economy. And, you know, we have seen the power of the largest corporations increase more and more and more. We've seen tax code written to them more and more and more. We've seen, since Citizens United, their clout in Washington and the state capitals grow more and more and more. And, you know, defenders of the status quo kind of lump it all together and say, these taxes or regulation or whatever you're trying to do is going to hurt ma and pa. Well, most of Oregon's forests are not owned by ma and pa. And that's been increasingly true. And so I think it takes a kind of careful examination of what's going on, and not sort of a stupid conversation about are you pro or against business. You know, we're way beyond that. And there are businesses that really serve us all and serve communities. And those business folks have to make profit, and a good profit, to survive and be an important part of the community. And then there's sort of an extractive sector of multinational corporations that don't leave much benefit behind. And you can see it play out in just about every state.
So, and this isn't a strictly partisan issue then. Like you said, it's not only just not a debate about pro-business, anti-business, but there are also Democratic members of the state Senate who are against this bill, who now represent, or former members who now represent, the timber industry.
We are not doing a great job at reaching across the aisle in Salem right now. The trust level's low. You know, I'm sure you've seen all the walkout speculation and talk. So it's not exactly the golden age of bipartisan activity. I keep talking with some of my Republican colleagues. Some are more interested in talking to me than others. And on this, on timber, not particularly this bill, but on timber issues, I've had some conversations with Republican county commissioners who I think you would characterize as very strong timber industry allies in the past. And some of them are reading the articles of the last year about the shift in timber industry ownership and saying, you know, it might be time to rethink some of this. And that's particularly around taxation. But that's not to say this is an easy lift or it's a sure bet that things are going to change. You know, there have been proposals more or less like these for a long time, and they haven't gotten across the finish line.
Do you think the Democratic supermajority in the state house is going to help push this bill through?
Let's see. I'm not laying odds on anything. It's a really complicated and difficult session in every way. And for reasons, including the clunkiness of, you know, remote legislating versus being in the committee room together. Few major things are going to pass this session. It's going to be, I think the total output's going to be kind of modest, and responding to our crises, responding to the wildfire and COVID crises, that's kind of the focus. So it's not an ideal session for reform. But you got to keep talking about it. It seems to me, you know, this issue, people have been talking about the membership of the governing boards of the natural resource agencies, not just forestry, for a long time. And I think this conversation is worth having. My bill, 335, fundamentally isn't an environmental bill. To me, it's a good government bill. Good government tries to minimize the personal and professional individual interests of decision makers in the areas they're making decisions. And, you know, I think we ought to look at governing boards, especially in the natural resource agencies, through that lens. Are we meeting that standard? I'm not looking for zero. In the real world, we should have foresters and professional industry people on that board. We need that expertise. It's the amount, 3/7, and then there's some other seats that kind of tend to give a majority that doesn't seem to be getting down to the level of conflict of interest that would most benefit the public.
Well, I see we're running up against the clock now. I really want to thank you for joining me today, Senator.
Thanks, Ethan. Appreciate it.
That was Oregon State Senator Jeff Golden discussing his bill to address conflicts of interest in the Board of Forestry. This is Ethan Sandweiss with KBOO News.